It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, expectations to be a man or to man up can be harmful to boys and men. We'll talk with a UW student who is trying to change that. First, we're just over 6 months into President Trump's first term, but allegations of Russian involvement during the 2016 election have dogged the Trump administration. The president, his family, and his staff have repeatedly denied these claims. But last month, the New York Times broke the story that Donald Trump Jr. had taken a meeting with a Kremlin-connected Russian lawyer during the 2016 election. At the time, Donald Trump Jr. released a statement saying that the meeting was only about Russian adoptions and wasn't related to the campaign. Emails later revealed that the impetus behind the meeting was a promise of incriminating evidence against then-Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Now, the Washington Post is reporting that the misleading statement Donald Trump Jr. released was dictated in large part by President Trump himself. This potentially puts the president and his inner circle in an awkward position or worse, especially as the investigation into Russian collusion continues. Elizabeth Sherman joins us now to talk about the political and legal ramifications of this news. She's an assistant professor of American politics at American University's School of Public Affairs. Elizabeth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith.
As someone who studies political science and law, what does this news signal to you?
Well, I think that Donald Trump realized that the meeting between representatives of the Russian government, who promised some very incriminating information on Hillary Clinton, as you said, was a huge problem, potentially a legal problem. Remember, Donald Trump and all of his advisors, Kellyanne Conway, everyone on the campaign, Sean Spicer, the whole group said, no way. Never made any connection. This is all fake news, fake news. So when the truth came to light that Don Jr. and Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner had all met with the Russians after all, I think the question became how to limit the damage. So now we know that Donald Trump said, I'll take charge of this. I know how to handle this. So he put out a message, apparently, said, you know, nothing here. Just an innocent chat about, poor Russian children and adoptions.
And what do we know about kind of the sequence of events? This happened during the G20 meeting in Germany. How was it that President Trump got personally involved and drafted this message?
Well, I think that, you know, the news was leaking out. About the fact, as I said, that these people, his closest advisors, Manafort, his son, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had met with the Russians, and it was all about damage control. And so, they're on the plane, and you can imagine the scene. Remember, you know, obviously Donald Trump is the patriarch of the family. You know, he's the boss. He's the take-charge kind of guy, and apparently he said, okay, here's the message. Let's put this out there. Very, very innocent meeting. Nothing here. Move on. I think that the concerning part of it is that the president's own lawyer, Mr. Sekulow, I think his name is, he either lied to the public and to the press, or he didn't know that Donald Trump actually wrote this very misleading, untruthful statement. Donald Jr. didn't write that statement. He didn't write this false statement. His father wrote it, pure and simple. And obviously they got together, they colluded on the plane to put out, what there's no other way to put it, Judith. It was fake news to the press and to the public. They just put out this message, nothing to see here, move along. So I think, the question you're asking is, was this illegal? Was this obstruction? It's just raising concerns about the honesty of this entire group. And of course, everyone is wondering if they're lying about this, what else are they lying about? I think also, and you're probably, as a member of the press, just as concerned as I think a lot of people are about the attacks on the press. Basically, ever since this word came out that, Donald Trump wrote the statement, okay, it makes sense that he would. He's not going to leave this up to his, you know, his staff or his underlings or someone else. He's the take charge guy. He wrote it. Okay, he put it out there. But then an officer of the court, the lawyers are all saying, nothing here. It's all fake news. It's all fake news. These are attacks on the press. You know, it's just another example of how the message that comes out day and night from this administration is just one message, which is the press lies to you. The press is an enemy of the people. The press should not be believed, and that's what we're hearing.
I want to go back to something you said, Elizabeth, because you said he was acting as the patriarch of this family, and just today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders gave a statement saying that the president weighed in as, quote, any father would, end quote. And
yeah.
She said that the matter was of no consequence. It seems like there is a sense that the Trump White House is really functioning more like the Trump business empire in a lot of ways.
Of course, Judith. Absolutely. 100%. Everybody knows that. It's obvious every single day he's the big boss. He ran as the big boss. Look at me. I'm a billionaire. I know how to make things happen. Look at Trump Tower. Look at my properties. I have all these planes. I have all this stuff. He is used to being in charge and telling, you know, his sons, his daughter, do this, do that, you know, do this, do that, follow my orders. And great. Obviously, that worked well for him for a long time. But now he's in some really difficult circumstances. When maybe we fudged a little on the square footage of the condo. I don't know what they used to do. But come on. Once you start lying to the American people, you know, they're going to turn you off. They're just going to turn you off. And I think people are beginning to kind of wake up and smell the coffee that, you know, it's just not working.
Elizabeth Sherman is with us right now. She's Assistant Professor of American Politics at American University's School of Public Affairs. We're talking about the news that President Trump himself had a hand in drafting the statement that Donald Trump Jr. gave regarding the meeting that he had with a Russian lawyer. And so you're talking a lot, Elizabeth, about how this could further erode confidence in the White House and President Trump's honesty, perhaps, in his being forthright with the American public. But let's get down to the nuts and bolts of this. Are there legal implications that are actually actionable?
Well, I don't think it's against the law for a president to lie to the American people. If it were... I'm not so sure we would have had that many presidents who would have stayed in office very long. I mean, a lot of presidents lie to the press, lie to the American people. You know, nothing here, nothing here, move on, move right along, nothing here. So, but the question is, you know, what did the president know? And apparently he knew about this email. I mean, he knew about this meeting. I'm sure he thought, good Lord, this thing is the smoking gun. Because for months he had said there's no collusion, we did not make connections with the Russians, we did not do anything with the Russians to hurt Hillary Clinton, maybe I sold them a condo, I know nothing about Russians. And so now this email chain comes out and everyone, including the special prosecutor, is saying, oh really? So, I mean, I think he was desperate to say there's no there, this was all about adoptions. And then when the actual truth came out, then he changed his story. And he goes, okay, all right. So it was about dirt on Hillary. But anyone would have taken that meeting. And, yeah, they sat down, and you know, but nothing came of it. Really? Are we sure that nothing came of it? Because the next thing we know, you know, as Don Jr. said, wow, we'd love for you to dump some of this, you know, incriminating stuff that you've got later on in the summer. So nobody knows what was actually said. Nobody knows what documents. No one has any idea what went on in that meeting. So, but everyone knows that they took the meeting because they were promised that they were going to get some incriminating evidence on Hillary Clinton. So, yeah, is that a smoking gun? Of course it is. I mean, it just demolished their whole line that there's no there. Now, you know, the president sat down and said, okay, let's let's try and, you know, throw them off. Let's get the press off our tail. Let's get the public. Let's just convince them that this was all about little children who need to be adopted. You know, it just shows that the president is actively involved in trying to throw sand in the gears. And, you know, firing Comey was throwing sand in the gears. Trying to get rid of Jeff Sessions is throwing sand in the gears. And, you know, why is he doing this? That's the question the special prosecutor will ask and answer.
Elizabeth, you said that, you know, people are starting to wake up to what the reality is of this administration. But recent polls have showed that people who voted for Donald Trump still stand by him by an incredibly large margin. And so is there not the risk that this is actually shoring up the argument that President Trump has been making, that it is a witch hunt, that he is under scrutiny in a way that other administrations have not been?
You know, I don't think it is. I don't think that it's a witch hunt to ask and answer your question. But on the question about his supporters, Judith, I think that you have to realize 63 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. Now, who were they, and are they really sticking with him? As you say, registered Republicans are sticking with him. Registered Republicans, Judith, are 25% of the electorate. In other words, the people who vote. Now,
right.
How many people voted in this election? I mean, now we're down to, it was like 58% of eligible voters, right? So, in other words, of the people who actually voted, of the people, you know, of the electorate, 25% are registered Republicans. 40% of all voters, of all registered voters, are independents. That's where he's having some real problems. The independents are leaving. They may have decided for a lot of reasons. I'm not. You know what? You know this whole thing with the Democrats. I'm not going for that. I'm going for this guy. He's a businessman. He says he's going to fix it for whatever reason. Maybe they distrusted Hillary. Maybe they hated Hillary. Maybe they thought she was terrible for whatever reason. But, you know, they might have been, a lot of voters were on the fence. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump had the highest disapproval ratings the day of the election of any two candidates in the history of the United States. So what we know is that the rock-ribbed Republicans, as they are always known, are sticking with him. There are not that many of those people. The other people that are sticking with him are the evangelicals. They care about one thing and one thing only, and that is social values, abortion, gay rights. They're thrilled about Judge Gorsuch. Wonderful. They got that. You know, the rest is they could care less. That's all they care about. They're not going to vote for Democrats. The very wealthy are big supporters of Donald Trump. Why? They have two questions for Donald Trump and for, you know, our Republican Congress. They have two questions, which is, when are you going to lower my taxes? And when are you going to get rid of those regulations on my business?
And we'll have to leave it there. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure.
Elizabeth Sherman is an assistant professor of American politics at American University's School of Public Affairs. She joined us today to talk about the allegations that President Trump helped to draft Donald Trump Jr.'s misleading statement about his meeting with a Russian lawyer during the 2016 election. Coming up, a UW-Madison student wants to help other men deal with the effects of what he calls toxic masculinity. Stay with us here on Central Time. A UW-Madison undergraduate is encouraging other men to talk back to the concept of masculinity and to express how those expectations have been damaging to them. The Dear Masculinity Project asks men to submit short essays in the form of a letter that tell what they've lost out on because of having to be tough and stoic. Some of those essays have been turned into short videos, like this one by Quan Logan.
Dear Masculinity, I'm writing to you because I lost myself, within you and among men at the same time. When my cousins stopped looking like family, started becoming challenges to overcome, when my heart became as hard as the looks they gave, as the bars they lifted, as the weight we all carried, I knew I had been swayed.
Eneal Pickett is a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is the founder of the Dear Masculinity Project. Eneal, thanks for coming in today.
No, thank you for having me.
What first made you start thinking about the concept of masculinity and the impact it's had on you?
I really started thinking about toxic masculinity when I got in college. And like when growing up where I'm from, I was taught that I had to be tough in order to survive. But when I got to college, I understood that like that same mentality can be used here because of the environment that I'm in. And also, like, I have privilege being a college student. So I have time to think about these things. And I'm on scholarship, so I get paid to go to school. So I understand, like, with me having this privilege, I better do something with it, mm-hmm. that I shouldn't just waste it.
And how did you come up with the idea for the Dear Masculinity Project?
To be honest, I wrote a letter to my masculinity first, because I wouldn't ask any one of my participants who participated to do something that I couldn't do for myself. So I ended up writing a letter to my masculinity, and my letter was like to my father, because I believe hypermasculinity killed my father. And
can you tell us more what you mean by that?
Well, my father, he had me when he was 15. My father died when he was 17. He died when I was 2 years old. And like my mother always told me the story of how my father died. And when she told me the story of how he died, it was, long story short, that it was just anger. And the fact that he tried to confront somebody with a gun, and that person ended up having a gun as well. And what hypermasculinity do to you, make you irrational. So the fact is like, and when you meet somebody who's also hypermasculine, they're going to test you. So who's going to win within this battle, not of wits, but of just, like, of toughness?
It's almost like it's better to lose your life than to lose pride.
Yes.
And why do you think having men speak directly to the concept of masculinity is important? That's a really interesting way of doing it, I think.
To be honest, I came up with that concept because I'm a poet. So everything is, like, at my roots is poetry. So, I looked at masculinity as a larger system that patriarchy engulfs, and what patriarchy perpetuates, which is hypermasculinity. And having men, like, do that, because when you think of something as human, it's easy for you to speak to it. It's easy for you to connect with. So if masculinity was a man, or if masculinity was a physical being, what would you say? What questions would you ask it? Would you cuss it out? Would you say, I'm not really that mad at you because I messed up? Or would you say, no, like, you messed my life up? Mm-hmm. And I wanted people to easily connect with it. I didn't want to make it too complex, because when you make stuff too complex, it just gets lost in translation. And I want everybody to understand it. And I made this project for people back home who don't have the privilege of going to college, who can't, like, enter spaces that I'm in. So I made the project really simple for people that is not even in college to understand.
And how do you find the men to participate in this?
I had some friends from back home who participated, but most of the people that participated are Wisconsin, like University of Wisconsin-Madison students, and also some staff. And I had them write letters to masculinity, and I reached for people back home, and they wrote letters too.
We're talking with Anil Pickett. He's a junior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a First Wave Scholar. He's the founder of the Dear Masculinity Project. And Anil, this idea of masculinity seems to interfere with men's relationships with other men, but really everyone in their lives. Here's a portion of a video done by a Johnny Carr.
Should I be tougher since my skin is black? Should I treat women like objects and aspire to be a man? Is it okay to let my heart to give and accept love? Am I acting too soft? Is being a real man something I lost sight of? When sad topics come up, I can never focus. And it's sad because nobody will ever notice. Because inside of my mind, I always hold this. Why won't you let me let go of my pride? When I'm feeling down, man, I always hide. She told me to tell her how I felt, and I tried, I really tried. But why you make me put my feelings to the side?
Why do you make me put my feelings to the side? Is that something that you hear from a lot of the men, that it's not that they don't have those feelings, it's that they don't feel like they can express them?
Exactly. Like, a lot of men, like, they were taught not to express their feelings. So as they get older, they don't know how to express them at all. and they become like so stoic and so cold and so like violent and so aggressive. And you sometimes you'd be like, who hurt you? Like, what is happening? And we, I can talk about how masculinity affects men, which it does, hypermasculinity, but it also affects women too. The fact how men abuse or inflict violence upon women. And that's also a result of toxic and hypermasculinity. And I had somebody ask me, come up to me, was like, do you think of people can have healthy masculinity? And with that, I'm grappling with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't wanna, like, for me at this moment in my life, no. Because I don't know, the compass of masculinity is just, is rooted in violence. And I don't know, like, healthy masculinity. And I can be wrong, but it's like, I don't know, I just view masculinity as so dangerous because that's all I've seen.
Dear Masculinity is going to be staged in your hometown of mm-hmm. Chicago as part of a play festival at the Goodman Theater later this summer. What do you hope that audience members will take away from it?
I want people to see that you cannot destroy hypermasculinity and toxic masculinity just with one person. It takes a group of people to dismantle a system or to destroy it. And that's what I really want people to take away. That yes, these systems are in place, but it's going to take a bunch of us to destroy it. Because it took a bunch of us to build it.
And what would you say to boys and men who are struggling with what they think society and those around them expect of them?
I would say, be human. If you want to cry, cry. If you like pink things, wear pink things. If you like fingernail polish, wear fingernail polish. Like, the standards we have of men is absolutely ridiculous. For them to act and for them like to portray themselves, because a lot of them have identity issues. They don't know who they really are because they've been lied to all this time.
Anil, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you.
Anil Pickett is a junior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is a first wave scholar. He joined us to talk about the project that he founded, Dear Masculinity. Coming up after the news, dealing with ongoing health concerns is hard, but what if doctors can't pinpoint what's wrong? I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, millennials have a more favorable view of socialism than older generations do. We'll take a closer look at millennial politics and how their views differ from other generations' leftist ideas. First, living with a chronic condition can be stressful, painful, and expensive. But if medical professionals either don't take your symptoms seriously or can't figure out what's wrong, that adds fear and uncertainty to the experience. For those individuals, they are either not given a diagnosis at all or are told that they have what amounts to a none-of-the-above disease, and that can complicate getting care and getting it paid for. Ed Cara is a Brooklyn-based journalist who writes about psychology, sociology, and public health. His recent article for UnDark about living with medical uncertainty is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
All right. Thanks so much for having me on, Judith.
Ed, what types of symptoms seem to be the most common in people who are difficult to diagnose?
You know, it's really sort of the vague kind of sickness that someone might associate. So fatigue, tiredness, body aches, just anything that you really can't pin down. That's typically what these kind of people tend to have.
And what are the catch-all terms that are often used to describe this set of conditions when doctors don't have other answers?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's all sorts. There's a diagnosis of exclusion. The none of the above kind of disease. There's contested illnesses, medically unexplained symptoms. It's just a whole litany of terms and labels you can put to it. But it all really means the same thing. It's like we don't know what's wrong with you, basically.
And there are some conditions that have names, but it feels like, first of all, they've become much more commonly used in the last maybe couple decades and seem rather vague, like those symptoms you were saying. I'm thinking of things like chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia or irritable bowel syndrome also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and these are also names that not just doctors, but patients sort of gravitate towards. You know, they sort of see it as a thing to reach towards. Like I have chronic fatigue, and that, you know, even though that doesn't really answer exactly what's wrong with them, it does sort of give them a placeholder, like, okay, this is what I have, and maybe that makes living with what I have a little bit easier.
And maybe it also makes them feel like, I have this, and I'm not alone, because there are other people who identify as having this condition also.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have a sense of how many people are receiving these broad diagnoses that really, when you look at it, mean that doctors are at a loss for a real answer?
It's incredibly hard to tell. You know, like the amount of people who are diagnosed with chronic fatigue is much lower than what we think might have some amount of that. So some estimates are like as high as 3%, but that's nowhere near the number of people who are actually diagnosed or given that label. Same thing goes for irritable bowel syndrome or fibromyalgia. But it could be anywhere from 1 to 10% of the population has some sort of medically unexplained syndrome.
And there has certainly been a history of women's health concerns being discounted or minimized by the medical establishment. Do mm-hmm. we have a sense of whether women are more often given these diagnoses or not given a diagnosis?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's definitely a mix of both. You know, women since the 1800s have been given this sort of label that their ailments or their ills are more mental. So when they are sick in a strange way that we don't understand, they just sort of tend to get more shunted into that pile. You know, it wasn't too long ago that women were called hysterics for having just everyday symptoms, and sometimes not even being sick, just being different than other people. They would be called hysterical for that. So that's still something that's ongoing now, and it's especially prominent among middle class white women.
What are some of the most common challenges that people dealing with these conditions shared with you?
Disbelief. Disbelief is definitely the sort of thing. You know, as much as we might not like going to the doctor, we still have an enormous amount of trust in them, in the medical system. So when we aren't given that validation, when we aren't treated as sick by the people that we trust, you know, their expert opinion, it makes it that much harder for anyone else to believe. And that just tends to lead to isolation and stress. And just you know, if the stress doesn't get them, if they aren't already psychologically unwell, then that, strangely enough, can make them even worse. That can exacerbate their mental health.
We're talking with Ed Cara right now. His recent article for Undark magazine is about living with medical uncertainty and having a diagnosis of a none-of-the-above disease, and that's posted over on the Central Time Facebook page. Ed, you start out your article giving a very intimate look at two sisters who, in different mm-hmm. ways, have dealt with this kind of situation. Tell us a little bit of their story to kind of illustrate what this really means in a person's life.
Sure. So the Ariana and Sarah Cohen, two fraternal sisters, fraternal twins, they grew up just being different, feeling different than one another. And one of the strange things about them in particular is that because they were twins, you know, close siblings, they, unlike so many other people I've talked to and researched, they actually never really believed that they were going crazy, or, you know, that word. You know, they always knew, and their mother always believed in them. They had a good, strong support system. But that didn't prevent them from dealing with skepticism and disbelief from their doctors. You know, they would go, they had hundreds of tests done, spent up to $500,000 in medical bills. And up until they were 18, they still just did not have any answer as to what was wrong with them. You know, they'd come home from school with very strange injuries that wouldn't heal for months at a time. They'd have just lockjaw, allergies to things that no normal person would have. And a lot of that was just sort of blamed on you know, what they went through, a very traumatic experience. They lost their father as they were growing up in their teens, a long couple year long battle with cancer that ultimately, you know, ended in death. And so a lot of what was going on with them was just sort of blamed with them dealing with stress. And it wasn't until they became adults, really, that they managed to get a grasp on something tangible to explain what was going on with them.
And what was found? What were they finally given as a diagnosis?
So they were given sort of one of these none of the above diseases. Something called, the main woman featured in the piece, Ariana, she was given a diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome and other conditions that we have a name for, but we don't necessarily know the cause of. So they also had something called the Iordanou's syndrome, which is a sort of a joint condition that makes them incredibly susceptible to injuries, dislocation, and then they have incredibly fragile skin. But even when they had those names, even when it was like, this is something we know, it would still take another six years before they stumbled on to the sort of research that I go into later, mm-hmm. that sort of more explains what might be going on with them.
And Ariella, as I recall, went to the hospital literally afraid that she was in danger of dying and wasn't even examined by a doctor. He just looked mm-hmm. at her, thought she looked fine, and sent her home.
Yeah, absolutely. And, she's particularly, it doesn't talk about it so much in the piece, but she's an incredibly tough individual. And it's very hard. When I spoke with her, she just seemed a very feisty individual. And there, you could not tell that she's dealing with so much almost constant chronic pain and fatigue. And it's just, she just sort of comes off as a bubbly, feisty person. And it's hard to tell. It's hard to look for what sickness looks like when it doesn't look stereotypical.
How does a nonspecific diagnosis or lack of a diagnosis affect people's ability to get testing done, to get treatments, medications, and to get that covered by insurance?
Sure. So doctors sort of have a term for these kind of patients. They call them medicalized patients, where they assume, perhaps wrongly, perhaps rightly sometimes, that these patients aren't satisfied with one test. So they go around from doctor to doctor trying to get an answer. And so they look at these patients with a little bit of suspicion. They sort of think they're nuts, basically. So they makes it incredibly hard for you to go to a doctor and get, you sort of just get laughed out or you aren't given the test that you think you might need. And it's a very difficult tension because to the doctor, it seems like this patient doesn't appear to be physically sick. So, the Occam's razor is that they are mentally sick. So you might not want them to waste more time and effort. But to the patient, they're just trying to get answers. And it's a very, very difficult struggle between both of them. And it just leaves a lot of people, out on the cold, not being able to visit a doctor or get any more tests because they just are barred from it.
I think it's a vicious cycle because these patients, these people who are not getting a diagnosis or not a correct diagnosis or not feeling like their concerns are being heard often have to become their own best advocate, as you were talking about the sisters, and they have to advocate for themselves and educate themselves about maybe what's new and what's out there for treatments. But then, as you said, when they go to the doctor and say, I want this, I want to try that, then the doctor kind of rebels against that, almost that challenge to their knowledge and authority. And so it seems like it creates a really unhelpful dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there are real concerns about people, turning to the internet or using other sources to sort of be their own, doctors. There is a lot of misinformation out there, and there are a lot of kooky things out there that, are dangerous for patients to believe in. But at the same time, our healthcare system, we don't really have a way to take care of these patients the way we might want to. One of the more surprising things I found in interviewing a lot of these people, and not just Ariana, but other people that I didn't get to feature, is that they were perfectly fine with doctors who didn't know what was wrong with them. As long as they were honest about that, as long as they were open about what they did and didn't know, and they would help them in no matter way they could. But what they faced more often than not was sort of this, if I don't know what the answer is, then the answer is not something medically sound. There's something wrong with their mind, not their body, because I don't know, I can't find it, it must be wrong with their mind. So that leaves a lot of more distrust between the patients and the doctors. And I think there's a lot of room for a more collaborative partnership between these patients and the doctors that are out there.
Ed Cara is a Brooklyn-based journalist who writes about psychology, sociology, and public health. His recent article for Undark magazine about living with medical uncertainty is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you living with a condition that has been hard for doctors to pin down? How has that affected your quality of life and your trust in the medical profession? If you've been trying to get an accurate diagnosis, what have been the most frustrating parts of the experience? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with Ed Cara. He's a Brooklyn-based journalist who writes about psychology, sociology, and public health. His recent article for UnDark about living with medical uncertainty is over on the Central Time Facebook page. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you living with a chronic condition that was difficult to diagnose? Or are you still trying to get answers as to what you're dealing with? Who's been the best ally for you, and how have your interactions with the medical profession been? What do you wish that doctors knew about what you're experiencing? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Ed, let's go to our callers, and Karen in Eau Claire is up first. Hi, Karen.
Hi. So I was in a car accident 4.5 years ago. I was rear-ended, and I have had numerous problems since then. Some of them, I guess the thing is, I keep saying to my husband that I've never felt the same since the day of that car accident. I had a concussion, whiplash, tore my shoulder, screwed up my foot. In the midst of it, I found out I had breast cancer. The list goes on. But I was finally diagnosed with fibromyalgia, chronic pain, whatever. And, you know, as soon as I get diagnosed with that, it isn't just too much longer, then all those fibromyalgia symptoms just go away. Hmm. Where did they go? I don't know. I recently spent almost 5 weeks in a balance study program because my balance has been so dramatically affected. Was it from the concussion? I don't know. Was it from fibromyalgia? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Karen. And Ed, Karen's situation and call reminds me of something you wrote, that there's really a growing understanding that illness is incredibly complex and that it's rare that a condition happens in isolation. Is that something you kept running into in writing this piece?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just that when we think of sickness, we think of something being wrong with the body. But, you know, our bodies, they have nicks and bruises every day. And it's just there's so much, there's a giant puzzle to our body and the ways it can go wrong. You know, we just don't know all the ways it can go wrong. And we don't know how the mind affects the body entirely just yet. So, you know, one of the diseases that I write about, you know, the lead researcher, he's had patients come in where, like, their symptoms didn't start until they had some sort of great trauma in their lives. You know, sometimes it would be an injury that would just sort of jumpstart this chain reaction of events that would lead to their bodies just misbehaving in all these strange ways.
Thanks for that call, Karen. And let's go back to the phones. And Narissa in Barron is up. Hi, Narissa.
Hi. This is a great conversation. I really appreciate it. In 1998, I was diagnosed with IBS-C, well, basically because they couldn't figure out what was wrong, and I was in a very small town. And then as I moved to the city, and my symptoms just got worse, it was just awful. I mean, it would be a month of just nothing.
So our listeners know, you're talking about irritable
bowel syndrome?
Bowel syndrome.
The constipation form. And at the time, they didn't even know that there was a difference between constipation or diarrhea. Mm. They just called it IBS, and they're like, well, we don't know how to treat it, and you're on your own. And as things progressed and I became more and more sick, I saw more doctors, and one specifically, he really tried to help after this fact, but when I first saw him, I was crying. I was in so much pain. I had been so ill that I had actually retched out my intestines. I had pulled the muscles in them. They couldn't figure out why, and it was because I wasn't digesting, and they couldn't figure out any of that, and he was yelling at me just because he couldn't see what was wrong, and I was crying because I was in so much pain. And then the next time I saw him, I was much more situated and very calm, and he was like, well, something must have happened. You're so much calmer now. And I'm like, well, I was scared. I was scared. Mm-hmm. Who retches out their intestines? Mm-hmm. And then eventually I saw a holistic doctor. I got sick of it all. My insurance dropped me. I'm uninsurable in so many ways. And so I saw a holistic doctor, and over time they figured out that it was actually my pancreas, which is very difficult to diagnose. It takes years and years, like, you know, 17 years actually, for my pancreas to actually fail, for them to figure out that that was what was wrong.
Thanks so much for that call, Nerissa. And Ed, is Nerissa's story striking a chord with what you've heard?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I, in my own writing, you know, I've always been very critical of sort of this alternative in holistic medicine. And, you know, I think there is definitely room for improvement in you know, self-checking against the industry, self-checking itself. But at the same time, you know, there are many stories of people who turn to these other practitioners and find relief. And a lot of that, you know, isn't just the mechanics of what particular thing you're going for. It's more that these doctors or these practitioners have more time to you know, be involved with their patients. You know, one of the sisters, she writes about how, or she told me about how she interned with a homeopath who got to spend, you know, 2-3 times the amount of time with her patients than a regular doctor would have. And regardless of what you think of homeopathy, you know, that means something. When someone can be involved in the medical care of someone for much longer, that just tends to lead to a better outcome. You know, and that's not, you know, that's not the doctor's fault, really. You know, that's just sort of our healthcare system right now. So, you know, all the answers you can find and all the medical research you can do, it's only half of the picture. Like, you need a proper healthcare system that can take care of these patients, you know, as complicated as they are.
Ed, in your article, you talk about a new area of research that could make a significant difference for some people, at least, who are currently diagnosed mm-hmm. with a none-of-the-above disease. Tell us about that new research into mast cells.
Sure. So, you know, mast cells are part of the immune system, and mast cells play a part in the chain reaction of things that help us react to germs, parasites. But in allergies, well, you know, allergies are just sort of the immune system not doing its job. They also play a part in that. So for the longest time, doctors thought that mast cells misbehave on the skin, you know, and when they do that, you know, we can get skin rashes, we can get strange allergies, but it was a very relatively rare condition. More recently, though, doctors are starting to realize that mast cells can behave in more than one way. And because mast cells are everywhere in the body, from our skin to our brain, this leads to the vague number of symptoms that people have. You know, some people have had this almost dementia-like state that might be the result of a mast cell dysfunction. You know, and that's that. Right now, there's been a lot of headway made in mast cell research to the point where it's finally being recognized as a potential sort of disease. It is recognized as a disease now, whereas, you know, 10, 20 years ago, people who had this thing, you know, they had no answers. And, you know, there are now centers in the United States where you can go and you can be diagnosed. You can be successfully diagnosed for a mast cell issue. And that wouldn't have been possible more than a decade ago.
And looking into the future, how long a timeline should we anticipate before this kind of technology and the knowledge that's being developed might be widely used?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that is sort of the disappointing part. One of the practitioners I talked to who diagnoses mast cells issues, you know, she referenced research showing that even when a disease becomes known, you know, when the first time we discover it or we have a name for it, it can still take more than a decade, you know, 15, 17 years before it becomes medically mainstream. You know, and right now in the U.S., there are only 3-4 centers, like in the entire country, where you can get diagnosed with mast cells issues. And you know, I referenced genetic research in the piece too. And there's only one place in the United States where you can get tested for that. And even if you do, you don't necessarily have the answers needed. So this is still, you know, this is the very beginning of this sort of research. And it might be decades before we, you know, we can reliably test and diagnose and prevent this sort of disease.
A caller in Madison, Maurice, said, if what you have isn't measurable with tests, then doctors don't seem to care. And Ed, do you think that there is a growing understanding, maybe, or appreciation in the medical field that, you know, maybe it's not all black and white. It's either this or it's nothing. Maybe, you know, maybe it's this, but it wasn't there before because the person hadn't gone through that stressful episode. Do you feel like the medical profession is developing in those ways?
You know, inertia, there's a lot of medical inertia that just sort of takes a while for things to change. But I do think there has been a growing cultural shift in how we look at health and how we appreciate it. One of the sisters, in fact, is going to become a doctor, or actually has graduated from medical school. And she and her sister, you know, one of the more inspirational moments is they gave a lecture to a bunch of medical students. And a lot of them seemed receptive to this idea that not knowing anything or not knowing the answer to something doesn't, it's not the end of the road. You know, you can still work with your patient to provide them the best kind of health care that you can and, you know, wait for the answers to come along.
And Ed, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Ed Cara is a Brooklyn-based journalist writing about psychology, sociology, and public health. His recent article for UnDark about living with a none-of-the-above disease is posted over on the Central Time Facebook page. The new Milwaukee Bucks Stadium will be a great place to watch sports, and it seems like it will also be a wonderful venue to see the work of Wisconsin artists. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Bucks president Peter Fagan said that the new arena will display lots of art, from murals along the concourses to paintings in the private clubs, sculptures in the public plaza. He even said the bathrooms will be filled with art. It's a pretty big effort. The Bucks plan to place more than 800 artworks around the 30-acre campus, and they want half of those to be by Wisconsin artists or by artists with a strong tie to the Badger State. Artists who would like to be considered for the arena collection need to submit information by August 23rd. We have a link to an article with how to apply over on the Central Time Facebook page, and if you get chosen, we definitely want to hear about it. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And then we'll talk to one historian who says millennial leftists have less in common with the new left of the 1960s and more with the old left of the 1930s. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.